So, a little bit about me. If you don't know who I am, my name's Liam. I'm one of the SharePoint MVP guys. I work for Protivity. I have some courses on Pluralsight. You can feel free to contact me. Maybe I'll respond to you, who knows. But feel free to reach out. But more importantly, what are we actually going to talk about today? SharePoint, yes. We're here to talk about Windows 7. That's what we're going to talk about. No. So we're going to talk about, first of all, why you would protect. We need to understand the principle of data security, what that really means. Then we'll actually talk about data security itself, and I'll break it into three chunks. One will be, let's talk about back-end security, let's talk about front-end security, and then let's talk about the end-user security, because it kind of flows together. And then we'll talk about compliance. We'll look at core features and components that combine everything together, and then we'll kind of wrap up talking about data loss prevention, kind of where it's at, and go through the flow. So, the question, why would we protect? Why would you want to protect your content? Is your content that important that you have to protect it? Have you ever really sat down and thought about the content that everybody stresses about and realized it's just a bunch of Word documents and Excel spreadsheets? But is it important to your organization? So let's talk about why then. Is it business critical content? Would your business suffer if that content disappeared? Or would you be able to continue working? Is it your own IP, unique to your organization? If it is, of course you want to protect it. You don't want everybody else to steal your stuff and create a new business based on the same thing that you've spent all those years building. Does it contain personal information? This is a weird one, because really the question is, should you be putting personal information in SharePoint in the first place? But does it contain personal information? Does it contain your last salary review? Does it contain disciplinary action? Does it contain PII data that's stored in there? Are you required to have it protected by kind of some kind of legislation, some kind of guidelines, some kind of rules that are part of what you do? Is there some litigation that's going on that requires you to have things on hold? So these are kind of some areas where kind of help you think, why are we actually protecting the data? Why are we worrying about the data if it really doesn't fit into any of these? If it's just the stuff that people create that doesn't really mean anything, do we really have to stress about it, about really securing it? So what are we protecting against? Have you ever wondered that? You ever sat there and thought, why are we spending so much money protecting content, and what are we actually protecting it against? Ever had that? The magical disappearing content? Who works in support, like IT support, whatever else? You ever had those phone calls? It's just gone. And you're like, no. Like, yeah, it just disappeared. And then you find they moved it into a different folder without them knowing. That's the purse one, is it? It's like, ha-ha, it's gone. We're protecting against disappearing content. We know that that's actually an issue between the chair and the screen. That's where that issue is, but it's disappearing content nonetheless. Destruction. I'm not saying somebody threw a bomb at your organization and blew it up, but destruction of content. Someone physically gets rid of it, doesn't know it's been deleted. I've always wondered that. You ever wondered? Someone says, well, I deleted it. And you're like, well, why'd you delete it? Well, I didn't mean to. It asks you if you want to delete it. Yes, it's a trick question. Like, how does that work? What about malware? Anybody had malware in their organization at any point? Everybody who says no, I would check your environment now, because you probably do have some malware in there. But malware will destroy content. And then failures, hardware failures, things that just destroy. Anybody had a failed hard disk? Yep, anybody got bored of having failed hard disks? It happens, stuff sometimes, or backups. It's like, let's restore from the backup from last week. Oh, that backup didn't work. And you're like, oh, that's an awkward moment. Go back to the people and go, you know what? We don't actually have the backup from a week ago. And they're like, well, what do you do as a job? I just sit there, backing up your stuff. That's all I do. So these are the kind of four basic things that we're kind of protecting from. The disappearing content, things just magically deleting themselves, malware that might cause an issue, or maybe some kind of failure. That's really the four things. Now the question is, Who are you actually protecting against? So let's go with number one. Employees. We're protecting them against themselves. We're like martyrs, aren't we? It's for your own good. It's what I tell my kids. It's for your own good. This is for your own benefit if we put this in place. So we protect from employees. You know, you don't know what would happen. You have an employee one day, wakes up, comes to work, had a bad day, decides to steal all your company IP and walks out the door and you would never know. Or would you know? Do you have something in place that would either stop that? So I worked at an organization many years ago where to mitigate this, they used a hot glue gun and squirted it into all the USB ports on the computers and the Ethernet ports that weren't being used. Basically just anything that was a hole in a computer was filled with glue. I mean, you couldn't do anything. It was like, that's great, but if I email it to myself, see? There's always a way around it. So we protect for employees because employees tend to be the weakest link. If you take some of the greatest hacks that have happened over the past few years, it's normally employees that have had the problem. Because employees by default are not necessarily security savvy when it comes to things like this. What about vendors? Who trusts third-party vendors? And I'm sure there's vendors in the room, and they'll put their hand, I don't trust any of them, no. But there's vendors, do we trust them? Do we really know that the person in that organization that you've given the credentials to is actually looking after those credentials? I mean, come on, should we talk about Target? The Target hack wasn't Target. It was the vendor who had Target credentials who got compromised, and then they took money out of my bank account. No, it's off my credit card, but. What about these people, hackers? Anybody afraid of hackers? It's like one person. I am afraid of the hacker because that is I. But are we genuinely scared of hackers? Is there anything you can legitimately do to stop someone hacking in? I can tell you the answer. You just unplug everything. You don't connect it to the internet. You don't have any employees. In fact, you have nothing. If somebody wants to break in and hack into your network, there's a highly likely chance that they're gonna. It's the same as these guys. I'm gonna call it nations, nation states. You know, we have some organizations here in the US that are pretty good at this. If they want to break in, they will break in. So these are the people that we're protecting from, but realistically for us as organizations, it's really employees where we kind of stop the book. That's what we worry about. There's not much you can do if an organized hacker group decides to break into your organization. They will do sustained attacks until they get in. That's how that works. But the key is you need to teach your employees how to protect their own content first so that if there is a breach, your content is secure and protected. You also need to teach them how to avoid social engineering. You know, that when they get an email that says, this is from the IT department, click here to reset your password, and quite clearly it goes to some random website, that they recognize that. So that's something I want to throw out there, is something that you guys can do. Teach your employees to understand that process. Understand phishing emails. Understand when someone calls. We did some tests a while ago, and I've done tests on my own. It's amazing the information that people will give you. You wouldn't think, like, if I ask you all here, if I asked you for your password, for your domain, you're all going to say no, aren't you? Can I have your password? No. But if I change the way that we do things, and I make you comfortable with me, and I tell you information about you that I've gleaned, you're more likely to trust me and give me information about yourself. So when we talk about data security, we have to go back and start at the principle of how we look after our content. How we protect ourselves. If you have a bunch of employees or vendors or whatever else that don't understand that principle, then you can be the best at putting security in place, but it'll still be vulnerable. So, there we go. So let's talk about data security then. So securing content, this is obviously one of the most important things that you guys are going to end up doing. How to protect and secure it. The first thing we have to do is understand this. Anybody understand all of SharePoint permissions and have got it perfectly right in their environment? Yeah. halfway through. It's a mix, isn't it? Do we really understand? Like, do we do the official approach, which is, you know, you build your SharePoint environment and then we delegate out to these power users and you give them permission to sort out their own permissions? Anybody do that? Do a show of hands. Has that worked out well for you? No. No, it hasn't. Of course it doesn't. Because what are you doing? You're giving permission to people that don't understand how to assign permissions in the first place. All they do is, I'm going to be the power user, and someone says, hey, Liam, can I have access to that? Yes, you can. And I give you access to it. Because there's no justification process. Whereas if we come to you guys, and you're the IT security guy, you'd be like, what do you want access to? Well, why do you want that? Justify it to me. It's a different mindset. So we have to understand permissions and scopes. So SharePoint's pretty good for this. It's really straightforward. We have web apps, site collections, sites, listen libraries, and folders. Really straightforward. And then we have a bunch of items. That's our security permission structure. We have an outline of this. The users then will get access to any of these specific objects within that structure. Web applications, site collections, sites. Hopefully, you've done it right. So all the users tend to get access to the top level of the site collections. There shouldn't really be any users that have, you know, super access to the web app. And then they'll have various permissions through the sites. So that kind of gives us a base understanding of what the permissions and how they should go. But actually, anybody really understand what this does? Inheritance and broken inheritance. And I bet if you look through your SharePoint environment, there's a whole mix of it all over the place. Sometimes we've broken this, and sometimes they've done inherit, and then we break it, and then add some more permissions, and then we break it because we want it more secure, and then we leave the accounts that were already there in the first place, so we don't actually make it broken. We have broken plus combined inheritance. That was a lot of words in one go. So let's look at how that structure kind of flows. So we have our structure again. We have our web apps. We have our site collections. We have our sites. We have our folders. So site collection, site, listen libraries, and items. Folders, we have the whole structure. At the top level, obviously, we have owners and members and visitors. You're all aware of this, so you know how this works. Hopefully, you don't put everybody in the domain in the owners group. I have seen that before, quite bizarre. They're like, well, somebody couldn't do something, so we added domain users to owners. Okay, that works out well for you. And the homepage keeps changing, but I don't know why. Yes, that'll be why. And then the next level down, which is the sites, the root level sites tend to inherit those permissions. And that's by design. They just inherit naturally so that the people who are added to the visitors group get access all the way down. And then, of course, we can go all the way down the tree and we can inherit all the way through. But then we could break inheritance in a library. So let's say we have, you know, half of us in this room need access to the library and the other half don't. Then we can break inheritance and add you lot into that group. So we can break permissions at that point. But then underneath it, the items then inherit permissions from the broken inheritance. So it's actually fairly straightforward to understand. Whatever the top level permission is, I'll naturally inherit unless I break permissions. The only issues that we ever see is when someone breaks it and then they forget to remove the reason why they broke it in the first place. So they, you know, if there's a bunch of security groups that have access, they don't want them, they break them, leave them there, then add more, and then you've just got this weird combination of things. So we can break inheritance really at any level. It's important to understand that because this is where most of your security problems come from. Because you've given that superpower user access, they've gone through and changed permission. They said, well, I don't want anyone to access it. So they break inheritance. Then what they start doing is adding users by name, not just security groups. So let's do a show of hands. Who's using just AD groups in SharePoint only? Okay, a handful. Who's using a mix of AD groups and individual users? Who doesn't have SharePoint? Yeah, it's gotta be at least one. No. Yes, SharePoint? Oh, I knew I was in the wrong session. But yeah, so we tend to do a mix. Which one's right, which one's wrong? It depends. That's the consultant answer. Perfectly. It depends what you would like to do. And that will be 5 hours worth of work or 1,000. It depends. But yes, it depends, doesn't it? It depends on your requirements. There's no specific right answer for this. Should I be using security groups, AD groups? Should I be using small site groups? Should I be adding individual users? That's down to your organization to determine how you wish to do security. So in the diagram here, we can break permissions and put them in various locations, and then we can also inherit in those locations too. So we get to break things apart. Understanding permissions and getting it right is number one in your list of data security. If you can't get this right, no matter what you do, your content will always be vulnerable to something. There's the amount of times that I've managed to go into a SharePoint environment and literally just traverse all the way through without actually thinking I had permissions to do that. I would challenge you to go back to your environments and look at your SharePoint, whether it's online or on premises, and actually go through and check your permissions. Run those reports that you can get. There's a bunch of third parties too. Run the reports and look at your security and see where the issues lie. Find those sites where everyone's been added as an individual user, and then go back and teach how to get around that. Okay, so how do we protect? We're gonna start at the back end of SharePoint. So before we do that, let's talk about versions. Who's on 2016 right now? There's about seven of you. 2013? Yeah, that's more like it. 2010? 2007? 2003, 2001, MCMS, you just keep going back. So most of you are on 2013. So the principles of things we're gonna talk about are gonna be the same, because 2016 was a super update. It looks exactly the same as 2013 with a few features that go in there. So we talk about the back end. So the back end of it, we're gonna talk about database access. So there's many ways of building out your SQL Server implementation, depending how secure you want to be. Some of the things that we've done before, for example, we'll build separate SQL instances for the different types of content that you wish to store. So you'll have an instance of SQL for your content, an instance of SQL for what I would class as auxiliary services, which would be things like workflow services or something else, and then actually have an administration instance, which stores all of your service applications and config database. So that isolates content, because let's see how smart everybody is. What's the TCP port for SQL? I'm proud of you. You made me proud. I've asked that before, and everyone's gone, I don't know. So for a bonus point, what's the UDP port? There you go. Oh, you smart crowd. I like it. We'll do some other tests on TCP ports in a bit. No. So database, so depending on what you want to build, you can build it very securely. You can have isolated instances. You could have the same instance. You can isolate where you store the content. SharePoint will support that either way. So when we talk about database access, we're going to talk about least privilege account. Anybody built their SharePoint environment in least privilege? Truly least privilege? A couple of hands went up and went back down again. Yeah. Yes, no. You said real least privilege. But a least privilege environment, it's a little bit harder to build out, but once it's done, it's solid. I remember working with some guys, working with some developers, and they were just used to being super admin and doing whatever they wanted to. And then when I came in, we built all the images that they were using as least privilege. Then they couldn't deploy anything, because they're like, well, I haven't got permission. Well, that's because you're not supposed to, because we're least privilege. Least privilege is exactly what it says, the limited amount of permissions per account. They should just be user accounts, nothing else. Utilize multiple instances, specific port control. Anybody using a non-standard TCP port for SQL? Cool. Doesn't make it any more secure. It's more about obfuscating. So when I come and scan your network and look for SQL and it tries to find 1433, it can't find it. But if I scan the entire range of IP addresses, then I would find it. But that's a good start, because we're using different ports to limit certain things that might come into the organization. Because if I can go online and download a tool that lets me find every SQL server in your environment, then so can you. But I might be the disgruntled employee that does that one. Apply security policies. Anybody still turning the Windows firewall off the servers? That's a good thing. Nobody's going to fess up to that anyway. But I've seen that a few times where the firewall gets switched off. Well, I couldn't connect, so I turned the firewall off. No, no, no. Add rules. Add rules into the firewall to allow the traffic. And actually, there's a mode in Windows Firewall for isolation. So you can then control the servers that talk to each other. Remember the old IPsec type policies that we used to create, where you can say this server can talk to this server and this server can talk to this server? Apply those to SQL Server. Apply those to your SharePoint servers. Make sure that the only servers that can talk to each other are the servers that are supposed to be talking to it. Then you've limited the surface area of attack. Then, of course, we can encrypt the data. Now, of course, this is kind of an interesting story because the two options that are available are really this. So transparent data encryption, or TDE, is the primary option that's available. Now, in SQL 2016, we have always-on encryption. Now, unfortunately, SharePoint doesn't support that yet. Well, just yet. At some point, it probably will. But right now, it doesn't. So all we actually have right now is encryption at rest. Now, there's no reason why you shouldn't be doing this. Anybody doing this now? Yeah, that's what I thought. A few, like literally two or three people in the room that are doing it. So what's the reason why we don't do it? Well, we often think there's going to be a performance impact. It's going to be slower. There really isn't. But it means that if I was to break into your SQL Server, steal the database, and then try to do something with it, it doesn't work because I don't have the key to be able to do that. So we'll walk through the process of transparent data encryption. It's like five lines of SQL to actually enable that. But this is something that we should be doing because now we actually have encrypted data stored on the disk in our database. If someone steals it, I can't get into that data. That should be a given. There's no question why we shouldn't be doing that now. And you can do that on a per content database specific, so not every database in SharePoint needs it, but your content quite clearly. So in order for this to happen, and we'll do this in SQL in a second, we're actually going to create a master key encryption with my super secure password. Of course, you would never be able to hack it. Password. Then we actually create the certificate itself, call it whatever we want to at that point. Then actually we create the database encryption key with AES 256, and then we specify the certificate that we wish to use, and then we alter the content database to turn on encryption. Now trust me, if it's that simple, why is no one doing it? It's literally that many lines. I'll show you in a second in SQL. But yes, that's how we do it, and we turn on encryption for that. Now, the next level on top of that is you can actually encrypt the SQL connections. So you're able to actually go into SQL, the actual connection, pass it an SSL certificate, and then from that point forward, when SharePoint makes a 1433 call to SQL, which it does internally, it will now be encrypted over SSL. That's a bit more complicated to get working, but you can go through that process. Okay, so let's flick over to this one. Ta-da! Okay, so here's the same steps. I'm actually going to do it on one of my specific content databases. So same thing, create the master key. I'm using an even more secure password, pass@word1, which is the standard Microsoft password for most VMs that you get access to. I'm then going to create a certificate called Ignite Cert. And then I'm going to use, and this is the most important step right here, if you try to run the create database one without passing in the content database name, it will complain and say, you can't do this on the master or the temp or whatever else. You have to specify the database you wish to use, and then you alter the database to make that work. So let me just come back out of here. I'm going to go and say create. It's successful. I'm going to create. I'm going to specify this and execute. Oh, did I actually call it the right name? Oh, here we go. That's because I actually didn't call it the right name. That was me. Execute. You know what? Don't you love it when demos don't work? There we go. Let's change that to ignite too. What? Okay, you can trust me on this one. My doesn't find my certificate. I literally did it 2 minutes ago before we started. But you create the certificate. Once it's created in the content database, then we can actually alter the database to then say, I'm not going to run it because it'll say, no, you can't do it. But it'll come back and say encryption is set on. At that point, there's nothing else that you actually have to do. It's done. 2 seconds. I will come back and look at that in a minute. Okay, so once we've done in SQL encryption, once we've done, maybe we're doing protocol encryption, maybe we're doing something else with multiple instances, then we have to worry about the front end. How are we actually gonna secure the front end? Like the end, the actual coming to the site. So the first one is site access. Controlled permissions, truly controlled permissions. Did you know that SharePoint by default is deny? Did you know that? As soon as you install SharePoint, it's deny because you don't have access. I have to physically add you to give you access to the SharePoint site. It's us that ends up breaking SharePoint security policy by adding individuals. So if you don't add users, you'll be fine. But controlled permissions. Inspect the content. How many of you have content inspection things in place to check what goes into SharePoint? Or do you check stuff on the internet more than anything else? Too often I find content inspection is done for internet traffic, but it's never done for stuff that goes into SharePoint. Are you checking what actually goes in? Have you done file blocking? Are you blocking specific things? The amount of SharePoint environments that I've found where you can actually upload an executable, which is bizarre. Why would you want to put an executable in a document library in SharePoint? Or even batch files or script files or whatever else. Controlling what a person can put into the SharePoint site will help mitigate some of those issues. And then, of course, limited access. Making sure that you have limited access, even you as administrators. So let's do a show of hands again. Who has two admin accounts? Well, a regular account and then a specific admin one. And then who logs into SharePoint using the farm service account? That's at least a couple of people. Woohoo! Yeah! Stop doing that. Stop logging in as the farm service account. We had a bunch of issues once in a SharePoint environment, and the person that made the change was the farm admin. Who was the farm admin? Nobody would tell me. Because everybody logged in as the farm admin account. Stop logging in as the farm service account. Separate accounts, assign the right permissions as needed. It goes along with the least privilege model. Because even though we stress about the end users, often mistakes get made by us, believe it or not. We may be the IT guys and the girls that know what we're doing, but sometimes we make mistakes. Not many mistakes that we would confess to, but and not the ones that people would often know, but we do make mistakes. Let's not be that mistake because we did something that we shouldn't have done. What about end users? How do you protect end users? How do you protect the data from the end users, I suppose? Well, the first one would be policies. So this is where we can define policies that control the content that's being used. So things like information management policies, rights management policies, we can use Azure Information Protection, we can use data loss prevention, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But we can use policies to control the content. Because remember, the logic is, when you upload a file into SharePoint, you upload it to the place that you have permission to upload to. But if your permissions are wrong, then it means often people can just upload stuff wherever. And then what you end up with is a kind of a replica version of the file shares that we used to use all those years ago just in SharePoint. Anybody ever seen that? Where it's like, hey, this is my file share structure, and now we have the same thing in the most expensive storage solution that you probably own. Anybody ever thought about that? You move it off fairly cheap SAN storage for file shares, and then what do? You shove it in SQL Server. That's really expensive. You may be using the same SAN storage, but now it's stored in a database as binary objects. Actually, it was much easier when it was on file shares. But we've moved everything across. When you migrated from file shares, because has anybody not moved from file shares yet? Okay, this halfway. So we're like, we're doing some of them. But yes, but the question is, should you migrate from file shares? And everyone's like, no, I don't know. We just shake our head like this because we don't really know. There's no right or wrong answer because there's still features and things that we need. SharePoint, no doubt, gives us great features over and above file shares. But file shares gives us some advantages too. So it just depends what you want to do. So let's go through and look at some bits and pieces. Let me just make sure my clients are working. Let's go here. Okay, so I'm on my super duper Windows 10 machine. I have a couple of them, but first thing this morning, they both decided to update right before the session. It's always good fun. I'm just standing here like, please finish, please finish. So SharePoint 2016, anybody who hasn't seen it, da-da! It looks like 2013, but has the waffle, or whatever you want to call it now. But yes, so here's my SharePoint site. Now, one of the things, I'm just going to flick back to my SharePoint server first. We'll just go to central admin. So one of the things that we can apply is rights management. Now, I often wonder why people don't use rights management, because it's just a role. It's part of your infrastructure. It takes a little bit of configuration, but it works great. So what we're able to do, if I just go to Active Directory Rights Management, we'll wait for that to load. So you can apply the role. Let me just do add cluster. Let's make sure to load while that's loading. Just want to show you that. Once we have rights management done, it's really, really straightforward to add it into SharePoint. Because when you build a rights management infrastructure, you can connect it to your Active Directory, which is obviously where it gets permissions from. The key definer here is all of your AD accounts need to have email addresses, which I would hope that you would have email addresses in your AD accounts. Once that's done, then you can actually come into SharePoint. You can click on security and do configure information rights management. And you'll see that on information rights management, I can either specify a rights management server, or I can literally just say, use the default one specified in Active Directory. So once I've installed it, it's just registered there. I actually have it running on a website in IIS, because that's how it runs. There's an IIS website, and I just connect it directly to that. So now that we have rights management, it's really straightforward. What I can do is go to my client. Let me just go back here. Go to my client machine right here, and I can open up Word. So the great thing about rights management is it integrates into two places. Now it integrates directly into SharePoint. It has done from 2013, but it also integrates directly into Office. So what I'm able to do is come to a Word document. I don't want to type anything, so I can type equals rand and get a whole bunch of content. And then what I can do is go to the protect document phase. So the protect document allows me to go in and I can say, let me just zoom in there. I can go and say restrict access to the files. Now you might be wondering why you would want to use this. So let's think about it first. Let's say there's 10 of us working on a team. We have some documents we store in a document library, but actually there's 3 people in that team that I don't want to print that document. I don't want them to do something with that file. Now, of course, the problem is SharePoint doesn't have that granularity of permissions. You either have access or you don't. There's no way of combining something that says, well, give them access, but don't let them do something else. That's called compound kind of claims, and SharePoint has no concept of what compound claims would be. So the idea is here that we can join these two things together. So if I go across and just pick my restricted access, let me just zoom back in here, then what I can do is I can go in and say restrict permission, and I can then assign read and change access at this point. So remember, this is not SharePoint permissions. So we still have SharePoint permissions over the top. So let me just come out of this and check that box. And I'm going to click more options. And then we'll zoom back in again. Now notice what we can do now. We can actually go in and say, well, I want to restrict permission to my test email address that's here. I want to do additional permissions. I can say the document expires at a specific point. I can restrict from printing content. I can allow users to read or copy the content or block them. You know those people that just perpetually copy and paste your own content and put it in their own stuff? No one ever does that, obviously. But we can change that. I can give them access to the content programmatically. And then I can actually say, well, mail the person. And then more importantly, I can say, require a connection to verify a user's permission. So now what we've done is we've now taken SharePoint permissions that are there to allow access in and then wrapped a second set of permissions underneath that. So that means now you can do that granularity of permissions that you couldn't do before because SharePoint doesn't have that capability. So I'm just going to come out of that one. I can say it expires and then give it a specific date. So let's say it expires next week. And I'm going to uncheck the options and click OK. So now you'll notice it comes up and says, only you can open this document. Other people cannot read it. You have a question?
Is there a way to override that so when that user decides that, oh, I can't get to that document anymore, or so-and-so can't get to that document, help?
So as the administrator, you can override those if you need to. Also, depending where you apply the policy, so to kind of override it, you don't necessarily have to apply a policy to the individual file. You can actually apply it to a document library in SharePoint, and then when it comes out of the document library, we can actually get the policy to come straight off again. So there's ways of getting around that one. So, yeah. So I suppose just to repeat that question, is there a way to override the policy that's been applied? And yes, you can. You can override that. Of course, it goes to that thing if someone goes on vacation and then they can't get into the document. You need some way of getting over that. Okay, so I can apply to that. Then I can actually go and upload that file. And from that point forward, that's embedded. What actually happens is it embeds something into the header of the Word document. And then from that point forward, whenever you take that file somewhere, that is connected in. And when you try to open it, it tries to call home. And then you can't open it because you don't actually have access. So it's an extra level of, I suppose, encryption over the top of doing your database encryption. So I hope you start to see the stack. So we encrypt the data at rest, and then in transit, we can use rights management services to ensure it's encrypted all the way through. Now, what we can do is if we don't actually have to apply it to the individual files themselves, we can go into a document library. Let me go back to my client machine. Let's do it on the server portal. Let's go to my team site. Secure documents library. I just created a regular document library. I can do library settings. I can choose information management policy. That wasn't the one I wanted. It was information rights management. Oops, I pressed F1, sorry. And I can then go through and restrict permissions on this library for download. So instead of applying it to an individual file and making the end user kind of determine what happens to that file, I can say, well, actually, when you put stuff into this document library in SharePoint, this is what I want the policy to be. So let me just escape and do show options so you can kind of see what they are. I'm just going to scroll down here, and then we'll zoom back in again. Whoops. Okay, so what we can do is actually we can say, do not allow users to upload documents that don't support IRM. So we can actually control the content that's going in now. We can also, remember, stop restricting access, which is what we had in the Office client. We can prevent the documents from opening in the browser, so we can actually override the default behavior of SharePoint, which is obviously open in the browser. Then we can configure the rights. You know, can we allow viewers to print? Well, no, I don't want them to print anything. Can a viewers run a script in the screen reader? Well, no. Can we allow viewers to copy and download content? After download, how long is it going to expire? So you can see that we can actually apply this directly inside the SharePoint infrastructure. So we can apply them to document libraries. Then when I put files in, this is what gets applied. So we get the best of both. We get the best of, I can do it in Office client, I can then do it in a SharePoint client, and then determine how that works.
I believe earlier you said that this works with users who have email addresses. I'm in a manufacturing industry where we have libraries that might be shared both with the administration office as well as kiosk machines out on the manufacturing floor.
Yep.
How does, for a lot of these users who don't have email addresses but they do contribute to SharePoint, how does it affect them?
Okay, so the question would be, if they don't have an email address, how do you assign that type of permission? So so for SharePoint, it's a little bit different. You don't necessarily need an email address to actually assign a permission because you're assigning it to the SharePoint document library itself. If you're trying to control individual permissions, then you will need an email address. And if it's a kiosk, whether they log in as a single account and they share it, that account needs to have an email address in order for that permission to be assigned. But if it's just SharePoint, you can just do it straight in a library, and then it will take whatever the permission of the user is that comes in because you're not assigning it to a user at that point. Yes, yes. Even though you are locked down, obviously depending on the policy you apply, but you can control that and allow people access to those files. Sorry, so a question here. Yep. Yep. Oh, so the question would be, if you have two policies, so if you have a local policy and then this policy, if, yes. That's right. So the SharePoint policy is the one that should override because that's the storage location that you go into. You wouldn't normally want to mix the two together. That would make it very, very confusing to go in and say, well, actually, it's restricted, but this one's even weirder. So, yeah, it normally overrides with the SharePoint one. Yes. Yeah. Yes. So if you expire the content, that's not obviously expiring the content, it's just expiring your access to that content. So it's kind of like a timed, and then you get restricted access. So the next thing that we could use isn't really part of the SharePoint on-premises solution, it's more of an Azure service. And I wanted to talk about this because we mostly should be living in the hybrid world now. Anybody who's in hybrid right now? Okay, anybody who's not in hybrid? That's probably the rest of you. Anybody know what hybrid is? Yeah. So the future is obviously living in the hybrid space where we connect our on-premises to the cloud and we can utilize services that are in Azure or they're in Office 365. Now, one of the services that's available to us is the Azure Information Protection Service. And I kind of wanted to walk through just a little bit of how that would work, really from the end user perspective. So what you can see right here is you'll see it says sensitivity. Now this is an add-in. So what you're able to do in your Azure tenant, you're able to go in and configure an Azure Information Protection service as part of your Azure implementation. What you're then able to do is install the client, which you can just download. You can put it straight into here. Once you've got it, it gives you this little idea of classifying content. So what I'm going to do is I'm actually just going to delete some bits and pieces out, and then we'll just save that. I'm saving it back in Office 365. So if I click the edit option, you'll see that I get some options, personal, public, internal, confidential, secret, whatever else. If I click on the secret option, I can actually come down and it will say, you know, what does secret mean? I can do my group or all the company. Then I have one called demo credit card. So what we're able to do is define a policy in Azure Information Protection in the Azure portal and actually go through and say, I want to define a policy that says whenever I see a credit card number, I want you to classify the content as this. And then your content gets classified. So my content is here. It's just stored in there. I'm going to add some credit card numbers. They aren't real, by the way. I mean, you can try shopping with them if you want to, but they won't get you anything. Notice what happens when I pasted the credit card numbers in. That was real time. It came up and said, you should change this and classify it differently because you have a policy that says it should be a credit card. So I'm going to click change now. And then what just happened? It now just applied something to the document that says, hold on a minute, we're now going to flag it across the top. We're now going to put a watermark in the file live because I pasted credit card numbers in. Now, this is great. This is a service that you can utilize. It's got nothing to do with SharePoint. But it applies to Office. If it applies to Office, it can be used in SharePoint. This file is stored in SharePoint. It could be stored in the file share. It could be stored anywhere. But Azure Information Protection will allow us in real time to define labels and controls, which will help your end users kind of understand the content. What you're also able to do is I can actually go in and say track usage, for example. Track usage will launch a website. It may work if I click it in here. We'll wait for that to load, see if it loads. Okay? So I can sign in a second. And what that will do is that will then track usage of the file that I've protected by Azure Information Protection. It'll give me an audit trail of who's seen the file, who I shared it with, when it was opened, and I can actually do a bunch of actions on top of that. So when you're looking at data security, don't just think, well, I've got 2016 or 2013, I can only utilize on-prem. No, you can utilize the cloud services. That's the whole point of hybrid. I think what's happened is we've got this idea of what hybrid is, and we think it's all about directory sync to Azure or whatever else. And actually, that's part of it, but we can utilize any of the services that might reside. So for example, if I click sign in, let's see if it's going to let me do it. And your password should be at least 16 characters long. Of course, the wrong tenant. So if you have the premium AD, it'll pop up the thing for you and say, here we go, I've logged in as the wrong one. But that means you can now track everything. You can also block content. You can apply a policy to here. Now combine all those together. Think of the process. I encrypt my database. I get the permissions right in SharePoint. I then apply rights management to allow me to apply a policy to a file that's uploaded. And then I apply Azure Information Protection to give me real-time notifications in the content to start training my users. And then we wrap everything else over the top and we'll talk about DLP. Question? How does that work with what? Sorry. Okay, so just make sure I have the question right. Can you automatically apply these to the files when you upload them to SharePoint? So right now, this one's completely separate outside of it. So you can set a default and say, because obviously what happens is when you install the add-in to the Office client, it will ask you to authenticate directly to the Azure service. Once you've authenticated in the service, you define what the default one would be for the types of documents or whatever else. So as you assign that, as soon as I create a content, because I'm logged in, it will then tag it, like mine tagged it as internal, or it could be whatever else. I prompted you to say change now, but you can actually force that. So as soon as someone puts some PII data in a document, it just changes straight away. So you can apply that instantaneous.
I think it's related. So the question was around legacy data, like why? The question, why don't we move stuff from file shares into SharePoint?
Yeah.
This is a big deal, right, for us.
Yes.
Legacy content that has PII in it, if I drag it into SharePoint, does the Azure Information Protection Service, for a lack of a better term, index the content and say, oh, this needs to be this particular classification?
That was like the most perfect question that led into a whole bunch of stuff we want to talk about. But yeah, so the question would be is if I have legacy content, and does the Azure Information Protection kind of pick that up for you? The answer is no, because it's a separate service. So it's not connected to SharePoint at all. Maybe in the future, but right now it's not. So if you have legacy content and you bring it in, it'll just sit there in SharePoint. But that's where we'll talk about DLP in a minute to pick some of that up. There was another question. That's correct. Yes. Okay. Okay, so the question B is it intelligent enough to know that if it's a credit card number, it needs to be this template or whatever else, like backwards and forwards? Yep. Okay. So you want some artificial intelligence that will just be like, ta-da. Okay. It doesn't quite do that yet. It would be nice if I could just put a file in and it would just go, ha-ha, just magic and figure it out. It doesn't do that yet. What's good, though, is if you do use the Azure Information Protection Service and you do decide to use it now, which isn't part of SharePoint, that at least if you use it now, if you move to Office 365 and start using the compliance security features from the Compliance Center and everything else, then they all kind of map together. So it doesn't quite do that yet. And it may not do that in the future either.
Yeah, are there Office add-ins on premises?
So this is the Office add-in for the premise that I've got installed right here, yes.
And are all the decisions, are all the rules being applied locally, like the content isn't being sent anywhere?
No, so in my example here, I am saving the content into 365, mm-hmm. but I could store it in SharePoint, I could store it in a file share, I could store it wherever, and the rules are connected to across the internet. So you still need an internet connection to 365 to Azure to be able to
get
there.
Right, but you're pulling down the rules and processing the content locally,
correct.
Right?
Thanks. Yeah, as soon as you install it and log in, it brings that down from the Azure cloud. Okay. Let me go here. Okay, so let's talk about compliance then. Such an amazing word, isn't it, compliance? Anybody get shivers when you hear that word, compliance? It's almost as good as the word governance, isn't it? Swear that's a made up, no, I shouldn't say that. Okay, so what are the core features that make up how we build a solution like this? Well, first of all, we should be using content types. Anybody who's not using content types, you need to stop using SharePoint. No, you should be using content types by now. It's been many years of indoctrination. Content types are the building block. Then we have sites. Then we have search. Then we have the data loss prevention engine that's built in. And then we have the data loss prevention policies. So when we talk about compliance in SharePoint 2016 on-prem, or even in Office 365, but we'll focus on-prem, we're talking about this. We're talking about definition of content. Make sure it's there. Make sure it's structured and stored. Make sure that search is working so it can index all the content, and then the DLP process. So, question, sorry? Yeah. Search and rights management, is that what you said? No, so there's no issue with search and rights management. Search will still crawl the content. It doesn't understand the rights management policies as such. Correct. Because it's a separate piece. It's not part of the SharePoint infrastructure. It's an extra piece that's applied over the top. So remember that in SharePoint, you apply. So if there's three documents in a document library and I apply a rights management policy to one, like you can still see it even though I don't want you to do anything with it, because your SharePoint permission still allows you to see that. The rights management piece doesn't remove and override that SharePoint viewing capability. So let's understand data loss prevention. Well, first off, the way it works is you have the content, you create it or you change that content. then the search crawl goes ahead and looks for that change content. This is the key. Data loss prevention is based around search. So that means it's not real time. So be aware of that. That's a gotcha. Don't expect it to be a real time boom. I just add something and it works. The search index gets updated. The DLP policy query then runs based on the rules and the definitions that you've applied. Then the DLP policy action is then applied to that file. So let's say you do upload a file that has credit card information or social security numbers. Until it's been crawled and indexed and the query and the policy actions applied, nothing will change. It'll just sit there as a file. So how does the policy work? Well, we choose the location that you wish to apply the policy. So you apply them at a site collection level or wherever else you want to put it. We then define the condition. The condition would be, you know, it's going to be underneath the US PII Act, and I want to look for some instances of this. The action is then applied, which will be, well, what do you want to do? Do you want to block access to the file, or do you want to just restrict it, or do you want to put a policy tip that says something? Those are the things that you then determine. Now, in on-premise 2016, we have a subset of policies. If you're using Office 365, there's even more policies. The on-premises one doesn't have as many. It's a subset of this. So for the on-premises, we have these set. So personally identifiable information, we have the GLBA, the PCI DSS, UK financial, US financial, and then standard UK PII. Then there's also another set, which I'll flick to in a second. We also have these ones, UK Data Protection Act, UK Privacy Electronic Communications Regulations, Social Security and Breach Notification Laws. That's it. That's what you have on premises. In 365, you have tons of them because they're obviously based around different countries and places too. On premises doesn't have all of those yet. So how do we implement data loss protection? Really, really straightforward. Well, first of all, those of you who are on 2013, you need to upgrade to SharePoint 2016. So step number one, which isn't in the slide, upgrade to 2016 first. Then you implement SharePoint search. That should be a piece of cake. You should be just search service application, done. Check number one. Then we define content sources, obviously to make your search work. So define the content that you want to actually index. Enable crawling of the content. I've so many times where I've got people call me and say, search isn't working. Well, it's because you haven't got a schedule for the crawl. That's why it doesn't work. Create an e-discovery center so that we can utilize e-discovery. Create a compliance center, which is a new feature in 2016. Define any DLP queries that you wish to use. Define a DLP policy. And then lastly, let the magic happen. Because then it works. It just does it. And you might be sitting there going, yeah. We've worked with SharePoint for a while. How does it just do it? But it does. It works. So let's go and have a look at DLP. Five. So let me go back to my server. Rights management. Okay, so. So we'll leave that there. So first off, just for information purposes, if I go to application management, manage, that wasn't the web apps I wanted, it was actually site collections. I actually created some site collections, and it's important because you'll actually need these as part of the process. So you'll see that I created one called sites/C, which is my compliance policy center, and then it also created another site collection called eDiscovery. Now, eDiscovery, I'm just going to launch Compliance Center too. So the eDiscovery Center is just a regular team site, but it's got some enhancements in 2016, one of which is the button that sits right here. It says Create DLP Query. So I want us to understand two different things. There's a DLP query and a DLP policy, two completely different things. Policies has actions and does something when crawl works. Query is something that you can do live. So you can say, I want to create a DLP query. So I'm going to click the magic button. I can click new item. And I can then choose the actual policy that I wish to apply. So I can say credit card numbers, whatever else it would be. So I'm going to go through and I'll just say US financial data. And what's great is it gives you the description of what it's going to find in there. It's going to say, if I choose this policy, it's going to go through and say, look for bank routing numbers, credit card numbers, and things like that. Now, of course, if you're in the cloud, you can define your own. On-premises, you can't do that yet. More importantly, you'll see it says, show results if the content contains this many instances of that. So if you say credit card numbers and then choose 9, it will never show any documents unless it has 9 plus credit card numbers in it. That's an important one. I've seen this a few times where they're like, DRP's not working. It's like, well, because nobody has 9 credit card numbers in a document. I do, but that's just for testing. But normally it's just 1 or 2 that seem to reside. So I can go in and say, well, actually, if there's 2, well, let's just do 1. If there's 1 instance of a credit card number, then that's what I want to show. What we then get is the ability to go through and name the query. So we can rerun this query later on. And it uses this syntax on the right here, which is called sensitive search. So we can define the sensitive types. So I'm going to say, I'm looking for a credit card, I'm looking for a bank number, I'm looking for something. And this defines it. I can go through and do start and end dates, as well as the author. So you may come to know that one of your users is habitually storing content that they shouldn't be. You can isolate the search to that individual to be able to come back and say, oh, it's that guy Steve again. We need to speak to him. You can then go through and say, modify the query scope. So you can say, search everything inside SharePoint. Remember, it's using SharePoint search. Or I can go and say, well, let's select the sources. I can say, add location. And then if I wanted to type like a specific site collection, I'll just use that one. It should be just portal. It would be easy if I had that, wouldn't it? Okay, so it comes in. Let me just zoom in. It'll say, okay, we've found the SharePoint one. You can add as many as you want to, so you can keep going. You can add different SharePoint environments. As long as you can connect to those, you can. They can be part of this. I can click OK. And what that gives us now is it kind of creates our search for us now. So now we have our specific filtering, and we have the source place that we wish to find and do a search for. And then as long as SharePoint search is working, you can go through and do a search, and instantly you'll see that my results have now come up. You'll see that I actually have some text documents, an Excel spreadsheet, I have some other information that contains, as it says, credit card information or bank numbers or something else. So you can run this at any point. I can save this query now and run it whenever I need to. Now that doesn't do anything, that's just a manual thing. Question? Yes. Oh, yes. Yes, so once, so the way it works, I suppose the question would be, I have an older version of SharePoint, can this work across that? Yes, you can definitely get 2016 to crawl across other SharePoint information. Once it's in the catalog, in the index, then this will run against it. What the difficulty will be, it works here, but what you don't get is the DLP policy action piece because it's a separate farm. But you at least you get a list and a report of things that have come out. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So the question was, will it work for large files, large content? Yes, it does. SharePoint will just break the file. It will look through the pieces and it will scan for that information that's there. Obviously, if you're uploading a 50 terabyte file, that could be an issue.
Now, going back to your putting everyone in the site owners group.
Yes.
Can you include a permission scope in your search? So looking for files that have this information that are open to everyone or domain users?
Okay. So question was, can you add a kind of permission scope to the search? So you can, once you understand the sensitive search syntax, excuse me, if you go online on the on TechNet and MSDN, there's a list of all the parameters that are available, not just, if I just scroll back up again, you're not just isolated to this that comes in that query, you can add to that one. So you can also add regular SharePoint properties. So content type is equal to whatever else, or the author or the user or whatever else. So you can add that information. Excuse me a second. But yes, you can definitely apply that as part of a regular SharePoint search. Okay, so I have some results. Now, of course, what I can do is I can click export. Oh, let me give it a name, sorry. Test. Export. What this allows me to do is, for fun, I can go and export everything that matched that query. So I can go through and say, you know what, I've done a query, that department's not going to believe me, so I'm going to export the whole thing out and send them a zip file with all the violations for data loss prevention. So I can do that, and it will say include versions of the SharePoint, include items that are encrypted or things that we don't understand but we've managed to find, and then send them that file. And this will give you a zip file, like you can extract it, and it's basically a full folder structure of what you've exported all the way down. Now that's great, but that's just a query. Now if I wanted to apply a policy, we have two different types of policies in the Compliance Center. The first one is a deletion policy, or you've got a data loss prevention policy. Deletion policy is straightforward. You can apply this and it will delete and manage things getting deleted after a certain time automatically. Because we all know that we suffer from that. Content just goes in and it stays there forever. And if we use deletion management policies, we can then remove some of that. But if I want to go and create a data loss prevention policy, I can actually go in and say policy management. I can click new item. Notice the same principle again. We'll use social security numbers. I'm going to call it Liam Test. I'm going to change that to be just one. And then what's different this time from the query is that I have a specific action. Question? Not on premises, but in 365. So in 365, you can define your own. On premises right now, not yet. So now we have the ability to say, I want to send an incident report to these people when content violates the policy. So this is where you would have, and you wouldn't send it to the person that created the content, that would make no sense. You'd want it to go to somebody else like, oh, I have a violation, I'll just ignore that. You send that to somebody who's going to do something about that, and then you can say, actually, what I'd like to do is notify the user. So I'm going to use my reports at dev.local. I can then notify the user with a policy tip that will say, hey, there's an issue here. And then I can actually say, I'd like to block access to that content. So we have the flexibility of saying, you know what, if it meets PII data, block it. That's it. It's amazing how fast your end users will learn not to put PII data in SharePoint. They'll just store it on their C drive instead. And then there's nothing you can do then. Because you know how that works. Or they put it on a USB drive or something else. But notify the end user and block the content. So once we've saved that policy, I'm not going to save this one because I can save it, but it won't run right now because I need search to run. But once that policy is in place, you then need to go through and assign the policy. Just because you created a policy doesn't mean it's going to work. So you assign a policy to where you want it to go. So if I click on portal right here, you'll see that my main site, I can manage the assigned policies. So I'm going to go through and say, I want to manage assigned policies. And you'll see that I can choose the policy that's associated to my site collection. So I'm going to go through and say, okay, I want to have Liam Test. Notice you can only have one as you select. Click save. Okay. That's that piece of configuration that needs to be done. Define the policy, associate the policy, and then SharePoint Search does the rest. We don't have time to wait for search to run. So what we're going to do instead is I'm going to flick back to my client, and we'll just open up my web browser. And then you'll see what actually happens when it crawls and meets policy violations. So you'll notice that my icons have all changed. What was a Word document is now a red kind of no entry sign. And then there's another one with an exclamation mark. Now, if we come over here and click on this, what we now get is access to the item is blocked. It conflicts with a policy issue that's been defined in your organization. So I can't do something with this file. It's now blocked. So I can actually go in and view that policy tip. So I'm going to say view. Wait for that to load. Oh, there we go. And it now tells you, hey, this is the issue. You can resolve it and override it. Here's a gotcha. Once it's been resolved and overridden, it doesn't then get flagged back up again. Now, you might think that makes common sense, but think it through for a second. It gets violated because of a credit card number, because that's all it has in it. I resolve it, and then I go back in and add a bunch of other stuff to that file. Because you've resolved it and said there's nothing wrong with it, it doesn't then get picked back up again because it remembers that you told it to stay there. It's a limitation right now that will change, but right now it doesn't. But I can actually click resolve, and then I get an option that basically says I wish to override the policy at this point, and then or I can report the issue and say there's nothing wrong with it. If you go in and just say report it and say it doesn't match anything, it'll just change the icon and put it back to normal, and it's a regular one. So you have some flexibility. Of course, you wouldn't want regular end users to be able to do that one. That's just based on permissions. Now, the other option that you've got here is you'll see this time it's not being blocked. It just says this item conflicts with a policy issue. So now what I'm able to do is I can do view the policy tip, same as before. It tells me its social security numbers because it's a different policy. If I choose resolve, I get the same thing again. So you have to remember that DLP in SharePoint 2016 on-prem, I'm going to call this version 1, because it really is, because we've never had it in SharePoint before. Question over here?
Yeah. If I resolve it and I upload a new version, such that 1.0 becomes 2.2, at that point of time, would the policy be reapplied?
So,
just because of the name that it...
Sure. So question is, if you have a file, you resolve the policy, then you create a brand new version of that one and put it in there, then as long as it's a new version, then yes, it would go through the same process again, and it would get picked up if there was a policy violation.
So using SharePoint versioning?
Correct.
Okay.
So what permission do you need to resolve it? You need to be me. No. Yeah, so I basically have administrator access right now. But you as an individual, as long as you have like contribute permission to the files that you're working on, then you can resolve those. Yep, that's right. Okay, let me just come back out of that one.
Can you move it with a workflow to an encrypted site or something?
Okay, so can you move it to somewhere else after it's a policy violation?
Yes, so can you use the workflow?
So in DLP, you can't do that one, but there's no reason why you couldn't have a workflow associated that when something got flagged, you could then move it. But it's not part of the DLP features. So DLP itself is version 1 right now. You can do more in the Office 365 version. So if you have an Office 365 tenant, you can go into the here. It's the same configuration. You go in, you have to go in and define the policies and assign them where you need to. A couple of gotchas. You can't apply a policy that will pick up list items. They have to be files right now, so there's no list item policy. So if I have a list and just import a bunch of credit card numbers, the policy doesn't get applied. So that's a limitation right now. Excuse me. Okay, so in review, identify the correct permissions. That should say identify, not identity. Identify the correct permissions. If there's one thing I always tell people, I give a session sometimes called the 3 pillars of SharePoint security. The first one is identify the permissions. Know the permissions that your end users have. Know how they connect in, where they connect in from, and why they're coming there in the first place. One of the greatest things you often do is I go into a room with a client, we'll put a whiteboard up, and I'll turn to them and say, show me how the end user gets in. I'm like, well, what do you mean? Well, how do they get in? How do they get in to where they're supposed to go? It's amazing how often we don't understand that process. You need to understand the whole flow. Implement least privilege. If you've not done this yet, go and get the documentation. Go through the pain of implementing least privilege. Also making sure that you have separate accounts for administration and that you can control the access. I would go one step further and start putting in server isolation mode in the Windows Server firewalls so that the servers can talk just to themselves. Utilize database encryption. use TDE or use something else. It makes no difference. If, for example, in the Microsoft data centers, all the drives are BitLocked. So they're using disk encryption. Then they're also encrypting the databases that they might use over the top of that. And then they're using other encryption mechanisms over the top. There's no reason why you can't do this either. Performance is not even an issue anymore. Utilize information rights management. If you don't want to go the whole Azure information protection, then utilize rights management. It's just a server role. You add it into your organization. It can be utilized with your email platform as well as individual files and apply it to SharePoint. That gives you an extra level of protection for those potentially sensitive information that only individuals should be able to have access to. Utilize Azure Information Protection. If you have Azure Premium anyway and you're connected across, then utilize that. I don't know why you wouldn't. It's the ability for labeling. Right now, there's no real integration with SharePoint on-prem at all. It's literally just cloud kind of connectivity. But the labels that are being assigned as part of Azure Information Protection are utilized across multiple components in the Azure stack. So if you go there now, you're prepared for when everything merges together, which is obviously is part of the roadmap. Ensure that your search is working and crawling properly, because it's not going to work without it. DLP is not going to work if your search doesn't work. If you have issues with it, it's just not going to work. Define your DLP policies and your queries. Queries for ad hoc, you want to run them whenever you feel like it. Policies for controlling access to content that's a violation of a specific policy. And then the last one, create great messages to explain to the end users. There's no point saying, some random message that just says, you're blocked. Have something that's a bit more like, oh, so why is it blocked again? Because trust me, when your end user goes into a SharePoint library and they see these funny icons, they'll be like, what just happened? They'll have no idea. So create something that the end user's gonna kind of understand. And then train them. Show them what it does. This is what happens when a violation happens. And make sure that you are not the bottleneck when it comes to the reports. Don't send them to you. Send them to somebody else that's actually gonna do something. Okay, so some quick resources. There's a couple of other sessions that were on about data loss protection, even though they're 365. You can go on TechNet and review some bits and pieces. And then I had a blog post that I wrote about DLP on-prem and online. So use the resources. Obviously, you need to go to 2016 first. That's the first step. But use the resources, and you'll be able to use DLP. So deploy and ramp up on new services. This is the fast track one. It'll help you to get to Office 365. Obviously, TechNet community, be a part of it. Make sure you evaluate your sessions. It's always good to get feedback. Whether you liked it or not, it's always good to know. And thank you for coming for the session, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the day.